Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and tonight we have a special program featuring the winners of the 2010 Writers' Cafe contest sponsored by the Writing Center of the University of Pittsburgh. With us tonight are five writers reading their winning pieces of poetry, fiction, and creative nonfiction. We will also talk with the writer Ellen McGrath-Smith, who will talk about the Writers' Cafe and the Writing Center. We'll begin with first place poetry winner Rachel Hutchinson. Rachel Hutchinson is an English major and art minor. She is ending her junior year at the University of Pittsburgh. She is originally from Springfield, Oregon. Hi, Rachel. How are you?
Good.
You were a winner last year in this contest, right?
Yes, in fiction.
Yeah, so you have a talent in different areas. Go ahead and read your poems.
Okay, my first poem is called Tape. Naked, bestial, he squats. Not over his own bitter heart, but my old bitter words, which fall to his feet, sticky clumps of masking tape that look like brains. Together we searched for the white of my walls, him peeling strips from my slanting ceiling, me sitting on my mattress, nose inches from the words, tugging a little too forcefully, remembering the desperation of writing. There is no read-through, no sentimental return. I wanted my room to look like the inside of my head, and it's time it caught up to where I am now. I watch my hands tear apart strips of words out of order. Those words, those fossils, antiqued paper fragile, marker blurred where sweaty bodies leaned, he says. I don't want to be surrounded by your thoughts from a year ago. I pull too hard, ripping off chunks of wall, letting wood show through. While he is gentle, reverent, but still renders the past irrelevant. Go write, he says. Go write, and I'll finish the rest. My next poem is called Seasons Change, Trees Remain. Shall we grow old together? I mean, grow into trees. I mean, faces creasing. I mean, bark forming around our intentions. Bark broken by carved initials inside a heart. Every ring inside holds the chemical profiles of years spent and medications tried. The rings are smaller where nothing worked, bigger where our love overcame. Our roots will intertwine more and more every year, exponentially and invisibly more every year, growing eyes in every direction, the scars or gifts of every sawed-off branch, until our eyes finally shut to each other. After a long life of sucking at dirt together, a long life of sipping up raindrops together. And now I'll read a poem called Dizzy at the Sun and Sky. I step out the door to a sun setting behind a city, beyond the city, reminding me the earth bends. And I'm dizzy. I'm dizzy with all the memories of all the times I've said to myself, my God, the sky is beautiful. Dizzy with the way it never gets old. The way it never just taps me on the shoulder, always hits me across the face with wonder. It feels so good to walk, eyes closed, knowing there are colors above that I'll never be able to meet with paints and chalks and inks. And to know that happiness has a place in difficult lives, and that pain has a place in happy lives. I'm getting that feeling again, where I'm dangerously small amidst all these colors and feelings, and I know that some things might never go away completely. And even if they do, there's still stomach aches and sunburns and holes in socks and jeans. And I think about all the people that believe I'll never get what I want, not with all this baggage. And I hope they see that all they need, they have. And I hope even more that that's true.
That's Rachel Hutchinson, first place poetry winner in the Writers' Cafe contest. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Boy, I really like the imaginative voice in your work. Really nice. We're going to move now to Ellen Smith. You know, she teaches writing and literature at the University of Pittsburgh and poetry for the Mad Women in the Attic. She is a coordinator of the Writers' Cafe. Her poems have appeared in journals such as 5 a.m., Cafe, The Prose Poem, Pearl, Southern Poetry Review, and the Pittsburgh Quarterly. She is reviews editor for Sentence, a journal of prose poetics. Her work has received the Zone 3 Rainmaker Award and the Asherman Tandon Award, HyperAge. She received a 2007 Individual Artist Fellowship in Poetry from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts. Hi, Ellen, how are you?
I'm good, Jan. Thanks for the introduction and thanks for having us.
Yeah, we look forward every year to having these great writers from the Writers Cafe at Pitt. Really nice program that you have. Can you tell us what the Writers Cafe is and what the contest is?
Yeah, for 8 years now at Pitt's Writing Center, we've offered workshops, improv sessions about every 2 weeks once the semester begins. We invite Pitt faculty, grad students, outside writers. This year we've had writers from Fairmont, West Virginia, local writers who have just published books. A lot of people participate and serve as facilitators for the Writers Cafe sessions. We often have themes. We'll have sessions that focus on, for example, should you pursue an MFA, how to handle difficult subjects, writing about hair.
Hair.
we've gotten pretty specific sometimes, but it seems as if writers of all genres seem to get something out of the sessions when they come. So it's been fun, and it's a great way to help people to see that the Writing Center is a resource, not just for people who are writing expository prose, but who are working in the creative genres.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for all the work you do. I know it's a lot, and there's always wonderful writers coming out of the Writers Cafe contest, so something's really working there.
We've had a great year, great facilitators. I'd say our program had at least 9 people who were not actually directly affiliated with Pitt. So a lot of generosity out there for people to come in and write alongside the writers. Come in. Mostly we do improv. People come in with exercises to try out. And that's a great thing. It feels almost like a jam session these days. And we need more of that in writing. Less workshop, more improv, they say.
Okay. And I know you have a lot of Pitt support, too, at the Writing Center.
Absolutely. The department's been very supportive of it. Director of the Writing Center, Geeta Kothari, herself a creative writer, has backed this from day one so when she asked you and I to get this started. And Jeff Martin, who coordinates the program with me, is a fiction writer at Pitt on the faculty, and has been great in helping us make this program strong.
Okay, great. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guests tonight are the winners of the 2010 Writers Cafe Contest from the University of Pittsburgh. The second place poetry winner in the Writers Cafe Contest is Melissa DeFada. Melissa DeFada was born and raised in Pittsburgh and is currently pursuing a degree in English writing at the University of Pittsburgh. Hi, Melissa, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Congratulations on winning second place.
Thank you.
Okay, and your piece is entitled Hair, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so please go ahead.
Hair. There once was a girl who couldn't stop cutting her hair. Today my name is Samantha. I am an architect. Samantha sounds like an architect's name. I have no children, but I have 2 Great Danes named Dixon and Diana, after Princess Diana. This is what I tell the hairdresser. Last week, I was a concert pianist. Before that, I was a lab assistant genotyping mice. Once, I was a recovering heroin addict. I kept dropping hints, hoping the hairdresser would pick up on it. She cut it when she woke up in the morning. She cut it after a full meal. She cut it during commercial breaks. She cut it when her goldfish died. Of course, I need to switch salons after each time. I've been everywhere within a 30-mile radius. There is a spot on my wall where I post maps and ads from the Yellow Pages. After I visited a salon, I cross it off with a red felt pen and print the date neatly beside it. April 16th, 1:30 p.m. My name is Jessica, accountant, allergic to green beans, divorced. She cut it when she wanted to cut herself, vertically, in half. Claire, the struggling philosophy grad. Miriam, the devout Mormon. Gwen, the perfect housewife with the perfect husband with the perfect kids. She cut it when there was nothing else to do. I've gone to the same place twice. I switched my story once. I had a dye job with Anna, and I told her I was a librarian. The next time, I had a perm with Jackie, and I told her I did voiceovers for cartoons. It was an experiment. I learned that no one compares notes. At night, she put her hair clippings under her pillow and waited for someone to come and take them. The tooth fairy, perhaps, or Santa Claus, or Jesus. every time I promised myself that this would be the last time, but then 2 weeks later I would find myself in Betty's House of Beauty telling lies to the woman shampooing my scalp. My hair isn't growing fast enough to keep up with all of these lives. When there was so much hair in her bed that it started to give her bad dreams, she began to put the hair in a box under her bed, and when the box overflowed, she began to eat it. Then she became the girl who couldn't stop eating her hair. Hello, I have an appointment. It smells like chemicals and burnt coconut in here. There is the deafening hum of blow dryers, the clicking of heels against the tiled floor. The receptionist has very brown skin and very pink nails. Her hair is lighter than her face. She snaps her gum like a rubber band and asks, "Your name?" I tell her my name. "You're Amanda's 1030, right?" She'll be right with you. It stuck in her throat like a clogged drain. It grew like vines around her voice box and squeezed. She could no longer speak. She became the girl who could not breathe. Amanda has curly red hair and blue eyes, her lashes crusted with a thick coat of black mascara. "So what do you have in mind for today? A trim?" When she died, they performed an autopsy. I tell her what I want. They cut her belly open. I stare straight ahead. Amanda locks her gaze into mine. We both stare into the mirror, vertically. "Are you sure about this?" "In half, I'm sure." And it was filled with hair. Amanda takes the shears to my scalp. Row by row, she shaves my head clean. Hair falls like leaves to the ground. It is beautiful. I stare at my reflection in the mirror. My expression is blank, but I look at my eyes, and I feel like they are speaking to me. They are saying, "Here I am, here I am, here I am."
Okay, thank you. That was Melissa DeFada. It's a really interesting piece. I like all the layering and the metaphorical surprises in there.
Thank you.
nice work. Next, we'll hear from First Place Fiction winner Nina Schaubach. Nina Schaubach is a freshman and fiction major at the University of Pittsburgh. She is from Fairmont, West Virginia. Hi, Nina. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. So what's the name of your piece?
Women Running to the Sea.
Okay.
On the day after my first birthday, my mother dove from the high-level bridge spanning the widest river in the city and was pulled from the water 4 minutes later, blue-faced and gasping like a fish. A quarter of a mile away, my father felt a sudden twinge, either an omen or his conscience, and at intermission left the Brahms concert he had been attending, pulling his coat out of the back of the folding seat and making hurried apologies to his mistress. By the time he had run the 2 blocks to the waterside, 2 things had happened. Dolores had resolved, having been thus abandoned, never to see him again, and my mother had regained consciousness, promptly vomiting all over the EMTs who had been so kindly clearing her airways. Neither lasted long. At 11 that night, my father quietly left the blank white room where my mother was being kept and escaped to the smoker's lounge, where he could speak on the payphone without fear of being overheard. First, he called the babysitter, who ought to have been relieved some 2 hours before, and promised her twice her fee if she would just stay until my mother was officially stabilized and he could leave. The girl, who was, after all, barely 15, and not yet used to defying the orders of older men, gave her word. She had already put me to bed anyhow, and didn't mind spending a few more sleepy hours flicking through my mother's vast collection of confessional poetry. Next was Dolores, who played hard to get until my father put on his most ingratiating tone, and wheedled her in the way she found, for some reason, irresistible. He longed for her, he said, for her Chanel pumps and soft nighttime suspirations, but had to tend to Joyce for now, who had chosen the most inopportune moment, as always. There was a pause on the line until she said, in the breathy manner she had found so appealing in Marilyn Monroe, "Won't you come over after all?" This he promised her, for my father was nothing if not generous. By 1 in the morning, my mother was still resolutely unconscious, though breathing as steadily as the waves licking the river shore, and my father told the doctor he would be going home to see how his little daughter was holding up. "Just 1 year old yesterday, Doc, and bright as a new penny, you know." And the doctor patted him on the back in the manner of men who do not know how to express their sadness, and said, "Of course, you get some sleep." On the way out of the hospital parking lot, to which he'd promised to return as soon as he could the next morning, he signaled to no one in particular and made a graceful left turn onto State Highway 27. His brakes squeaked like saddened birds when he pressed them at the first light. Our house was darkened but for the living room light, where my father found the babysitter nearly asleep on the couch, with Ariel denting the soft skin of her palms. "You can go home," he whispered to her, shaking her shoulder gently. "You were good to stay." She yawned kittenishly and licked the remnants of a late-night brownie off her fingers with her small pink tongue, thanked him for the crisp bills he offered her, and vanished into the ambiguity of another Saturday night. So it was that I awoke the next morning in a strange apartment, which smelled strongly of tuberose and baby oil. Someone had emptied the bottom drawer of a wooden dresser and lined it with blankets, pulling it out to lie among the strewn seaweed of sweaters and blouses that covered the bare floor. My father was just waking, bare-chested and lean, and the woman next to him curled closer into his arm, murmuring a low plea for him to stay. "Won't you stay, Al? It's warm here, and there's nowhere you need to be but with me." This was not strictly true. It was already past 8, and the doctor on duty in the ICU was about to discover my mother sitting up in bed, crying one word over and over again. Through her drugged enunciation, it sounded at first like "my God," which was not uncommon for near suicides, but was quickly established to be Margot. She wanted Margot, and Margot was me.
Thank you, Nina. I really like the willingness in that piece to address the difficult, brave voice in there. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guests tonight are the winners of the 2010 Writers' Cafe Contest from the University of Pittsburgh. The next reader is the second-place winner in fiction, Lawrence Lenhart. Lawrence Lenhart is a junior majoring in English writing and psychology at the University of Pittsburgh. He plans to pursue an MFA in fiction. Hi, Lawrence. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay. So what's the name of your piece?
It's called Old Parts.
Okay.
Our 15-year-old house, the 15-year-old appliances within it, each at their own time, sputter stopped or gave one last agonizing moan that summer. The Sears repairman came back, replacing parts for the air conditioner, vacuum cleaner, microwave, washing machine, and dryer. In June and July, my parents racked up almost $1,200 in repair fees since all the appliances were long past their warranty guarantees. With each, Mom's renewed exasperation. Pap offered an adequate consolation. "I'm glad for it. Means I'm not the only old thing in this house. I'm in good company." Pep smiled, watching Mom sweep with a broom all the crumbs and the dust dragged across the floor, and he preferred the slow-burning stovetop to the microwave zap anyway. And too, the chink-thwap of clothes massaged against the corrugated steel washboard to the electric purr, the angry bustle of the washing machine. This work, the old work, for several days from this week and that, the straining hands and passing time, as Pap's own mother once did. Best of all, a clothesline vine was tied to a pair of birch trees, and I could dance, wholly enchanted, with shivering sway of the summer clothes. When the Sears truck came again and again, the circuitous route back to our house, Pap and I would sigh. The repairman passed meekly by our game of checkers and waited for Mom to allow him inside. One August morning, my knuckles bashed on Pap's door. As usual, I came to wake my summer sitter. My parents were at their jobs, and us left to our play, a healthy balance between checkers and baseball. I waited before pounding again, a crisp rat-a-tat, but he was unmoving, unanswering. I went without him to the yard, and I shuddered when I saw how the grass had baked, the white and yellow hay, and somewhere by the table, rocks stamped into the yard. Pap didn't come from his room all day. Maybe he was just sprawled on the bed, stretching and unable to find a reason to get up. Maybe he was prolonging a favorite dream. I stayed on the porch, blowing soap bubbles across the yard, listening to the Reds game on the radio by myself. By the top of the sixth, Dad was home. "Where's Pap?" I shrugged. "He never got up today," I said. "It must have been dog-tired." "You didn't see him even once?" "No." Dad walked faster, a destination pace through the door. Pap, the old tinkerer, was gone. Dad called the funeral home and relevant family members in a sad, rasp voice. The house filled with flowers, white lilies and yellow roses and bell glass vases, sent from relatives in Washington, Florida, South Carolina. The word sympathy was given to us, as if those syllables, when whispered softly or with a hand on the shoulder, would muffle the grief. Leaning into his casket before it was sealed, I pressed into his palm the crown side of a checker, the king potential. Some weeks after the funeral, we finally entered his room with museum respect, to dismantle the memory that he was ever there. Dad and I filled the suitcase with clothes, all to be donated to Salvation Army. We stuffed it all. Underpants and undershirts, wool socks and collared polos, trousers and flannel pajamas. Mom was undressing the bed. She had the linens bunched and tossed into her basket. The comforter was folded under the bed, but when she stripped the pillowcase, she gasped. Mom, in her disbelief, sat on the bed and reached into the case, removing a fan motor, a thermal switch, a gas valve, igniter, light socket, and drive motor, all the old parts disassembled. Dad clenched his jaw, and I thought for part of a moment that he might finally use his raging tone in front of Mom. But his irritation was converted into a different energy. He laughed, and my mother, in her bewilderment, sat with the appliance parts on her lap. "That's the way," my dad said. "That's the way to go."
Thank you, Lawrence. I really like the immediacy and that sense of movement in there. Is that something you were striving for?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the idea that the older man has dementia and he really needs taken care of by his parents, so the young boy sort of contrasts with him, and because it's in his perspective, that's why it's so immediate.
Okay, thanks. Next we have the first place winner in creative nonfiction, which is Who Is Melissa DeFatta. Melissa was also the second prize winner in poetry. So I want to ask you, Melissa, since you write both poetry and creative nonfiction, is there one form you feel more committed to? Or?
I write in many different genres. I've written fiction, nonfiction, poetry, plays. To me, genre isn't really important. It's whatever form comes most naturally to what I want to say that is important to me.
Okay. Good answer. Okay. Go ahead.
This piece is called Letters in Case I Die. June 1st, 2009. Dear A, I am writing this to you because I know better than to assume that I'll always be around. That's what cancer does to you. You start to take precautions. You wear a helmet, you take your vitamins, you back up your computer files on a flash drive. I am writing this to you because I don't want to take any chances. I am writing this to you because of the movie we saw today. When the man's wife died, I began to cry in that way I cry now, silently, inside myself. I could feel you crying too. I know we were both thinking the same thing, the bad thought. You told me not to worry, that it was just a movie. I said it wasn't the movie, and you simply said, "I know." Love, M. In my dreams, I squeeze my arm until my blood seeps out of my pores. I cleanse it until its juices run clear, then push it back inside me, suck it up like a vacuum. I rip the tumors out with my bare hands. June 3rd, 2009. We got the news of the PET scan today. Things look remarkably better, but there is always a but. My mother told me that this was great news, to get out of bed and jump up and down. I didn't. I hope you understand why. I hope you aren't disappointed in me. Last night, when I was bleeding and hurting and yelling, you kept saying, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." Don't ever be sorry. I think I can't stand that word. Love, M. Dark continents of bruises blossom on my skin. When I knock my leg against the edge of a door, an island of flesh rises above my knee. The bruise is knob-like and beautiful, a petal-shaped mound of black and purple. Pinpricks of blood begin to seep through my pores, dotting my skin like a hill of red poppies. My skin is permeable. It cannot keep the blood in. The poppies sprout up and down my legs, creating fields of bloody flowers. I show you the damage. You plant kisses up and down my legs, leaving a trail of wounds in the shape of lips. June 28th, 2009. Dear A, you don't want to talk about this, I know. But would you listen to me if I were on my deathbed? I think you would. People always take whatever is said on a person's deathbed so seriously, which is ridiculous when you think about it, because most people on their deathbeds are senile or drugged out of their minds. You don't want to talk to me about this, and you don't want to listen to me. But in case I die, I want you to know this, so I'm going to write it down while I'm still alive. This is what I would say to you on my deathbed. Don't destroy your life because you're afraid of death. Let yourself fall in love. Let yourself be alive. Let me show you all the ways I love you. Be the person you were that night I lit candles and we talked. Love, M. August 2nd, 2009. Dear A, sometimes I think we're too young for this. Love, M.
Thanks, Melissa. Nice work. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guests tonight are the winners of the 2010 Writers' Cafe contest from the University of Pittsburgh. Next, we have the work of second-place winner in creative nonfiction, Joyce McDonald. Joyce McDonald is from White Oak and is a non-traditional student at the University of Pittsburgh, pursuing two writing certificates while working full-time. Her work will be read tonight by Ellen McGrath-Smith.
Okay, the piece I'm going to read is called Mother's Day. Every Mother's Day was her birthday. Grandmother came to this country at age 12. Life was hard for Maria in Italy, and her mother arranged for Maria and her sister Carmela to go to America. She was very sick from the long trip across the rough ocean. An error in translation was made on Ellis Island, and a wrong date of birth was recorded on her immigration papers. The confusion led her eventually claiming her birthday as Mother's Day. She confessed that this would assure a visit by her children on that day. We were never too busy to visit on her birth Mothering Day. Mothering, or Mother's Day, has been celebrated since antiquity, but the closest roots to what we know go back to England in the 1600s. However, when the first English settlers came to America, they discontinued the tradition of Mothering Day. One explanation for the settlers' discontinuation was that they just didn't have time. They lived under harsh conditions and were forced to work long hours in order to survive. Perhaps Labor Day was to pay tribute to those hard workers. Memorial Day pays tribute to those who have gone before us, not just veterans. I recall my parents and grandparents visiting and landscaping graves for Memorial Day. The first official American Mother's Day was in 1870. Despite having penned the Battle Hymn of the Republic 12 years earlier, Julia Ward Howe was so distraught by the death and carnage of the Civil War that she called on mothers to come together and protest the futility of their sons killing the sons of the other mothers. With the following, "Arise then, women of this day, arise all women who have hearts. Whether your baptism be that of water or of tears, say firmly, we women of one country will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war. Let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first, as women, to bewail and commemorate the dead. I passed the cemetery of my grandmother's grave on my way to get groceries. I stop to memorialize her about once a year, and half the time I cannot find her tombstone. I see people out of their cars visiting grave sites and wonder if they are in deep grief over a recent loss, or if they are lonely and need a place to go every day. I wonder if they talk to them and if they ask questions to the tombstones. This Mother's Day will be special. My daughter is a new mother. I am a new grandmother. My mother is a great-grandmother. There is a pang in me that yearns to hear more about my grandmother and wishes for my mother to tell me more about her life while she is still alive. Now my daughter is very busy with her life and may not want to know things she doesn't already know about me or her maternal predecessors. Does she care to hear about my first kiss, the stories of my grandmother, how to make real scalloped potatoes, or how to treat her children's fevers? I should really take the time to journal these things."
That's the work of Joyce MacDonald. The writing of the winners of the Writers' Cafe contest, sponsored by the University of Pittsburgh Writing Center. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.